Welcome to How Now, the podcast where we talk about how to live in the now. And here's your host, Kim Martin Raymond.
Peace and blessings, love and light, and welcome to this edition of the How Now podcast, where we talk about how to live in the now. I am your host, Kim Martin Raymond. I'm a minister, spiritual life coach, health and nutrition awareness coach, author and founder of Redefining You, LLC, where I help my clients to realign themselves, mind, body, and spirit. And if this is your first time joining us on the How Now podcast, welcome to the How Now podcast family. Please be sure to go to my website, www.hownowpodcast.com, and click on your favorite podcast link. Be sure to like, follow, share, and subscribe. You can also scroll to the bottom of the page and click on this week's banner for the show, and it will take you to the How Now YouTube channel, where you can like, follow, share, and subscribe there as well. Make sure you click that notification button so you always know what's happening in the now. Again, that's www.hownowpodcast.com. So let's get into tonight's topic, where we are going to be talking about why you feel the way you do. Okay, and that's something that's powerful. Why do we feel the way we feel? We hear common words like triggers. What triggers us? What are some things that cause us to have the emotions that we have? We hear topics like empathy. Are we empathizing with people? Are we valuing how people feel? So there are so many facets to why we feel the way we do. And to help us to kind of, you know, make our way through the weeds of it all is my special guest. So as is customary with the How Now podcast, I'm going to have him to introduce himself at this time.
Well, thank you for having me on your show. My name is Renaud Purifoy, and I was a therapist for 20 years, and I taught at a college for 20 years, psychology, and currently I'm retired, and I teach, and I write books, and I travel, do a little bit of teaching here and there. So it's been a lot of fun right now.
Awesome. Awesome. I am so glad that you've taken time out of your busy schedule to join us here on the How Now podcast. And, like I said, we were going to be talking about why you feel the way you do. And that just happens to be the title of your latest book. So before we talk about that, and like I said, take a little bit of a deeper dive into emotions, let's talk a little bit about your background. Now, I tend to do things prior to the pandemic because that was a bit of a stopping point for some of us, and we've had to make some pivots as a result of that. So, like you said, you were a therapist for some time, and then you also taught. So, right. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I specialize in anxiety disorders. So, when I first started, it was mostly panic disorder, and then I got into some of the other ones, social phobia, and some of those types of things, OCD. When I started, I knew I didn't want to do substance abuse and some of that type of stuff. So I looked around, and panic disorder was a brand new thing. And it was fun for me because people get better. I like wins, you know. So you work with substance abuse, you get a lot of relapses. It's over and over and over. You work with people, you get some successes, but then a lot of people fall back off the wagon again. So with panic disorder, it's something that once people understand what's going on, they have some tools to control the panic attacks, and they understand what's happening in their body and stuff, then they actually return to a normal life. And that's really rewarding for me to see people get back into life and do the things that they enjoy doing.
Yeah, I love that you say that toolbox, because that's a huge thing for me. Everything for me is about toolboxes. What are some things that we can reach for and access when we're going through a particular crisis? You know, I always say, you know, you have your spare tire and your tire iron and your gas can in your car in the instance that something happens with your vehicle. But what do we have in our, you know, mental and spiritual toolboxes to reach for when we're in a crisis that may be of an emotional or a mental, facet.
Or an actual physical thing, right?
Absolutely.
Lose your job, got somebody sick in your family, you know, those are just as big crisis as everything else.
Absolutely. And I mean, this being Mental Health Month, you know, it's definitely, people have been highlighting some of those things, but Just like you said, those are things that have been happening through the course of time. There are some things that may be newer, but there are a lot of situations that come up that, you know, we don't always have to be reactive about, but can be proactive about when we see them coming. Because sometimes we see them coming and we're just like, uh-oh. Just like you said, we have triggers, things that may, you know, cause us to reflect on something that we've or have a reaction to something that we've experienced prior. And it's just like, okay, wait a minute, I'm not ready. But it's like, you can be ready, right?
Yeah. Well, life is more fast-paced, but people really haven't changed a whole lot since the Babylonians, so.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
We still have the same stuff we're doing they were doing back then. It's just we got more things we're juggling in the air right now.
Right. And so, like I said, you were doing that, you know, initially. Now, here comes the pandemic. Do things begin to change in your business as far as, you know, the number of people or the type of people that were coming to you that may not have come to you prior?
Well, for me, things didn't change because I'd retired just prior to the pandemic. And so life went on pretty much normal for me, except everything was shut down.
Right.
Yeah. So I still got together with my small group and my friends and stuff. So it wasn't a lot of different for me, except for, like I said, there wasn't a lot of places to go to for a while. But then, you know, things started opening up again and we resumed.
Right. So, I know you had some things that were in person or was your group an in-person group and then you had to go to Zoom or other types of.
Our small group, we did Zoom for a while. And then when we were able to get back together in the church group and, you know, I play in the band at church. And so I wasn't able to do that for a while. And so, of course, once they opened back up and I was able to get back and do that again. So I'm back on Sunday mornings doing my guitar. So.
That's beautiful. And I mean, I said that because I believe we all kind of went through, a pivot during that time. It was just like, okay, I have to do things a little different from the way I was previously doing them. And for some, they were able to make that transition easily. And for others, it was a little more difficult, right?
And there was so much paranoia back then, you know, and a lot of it, unfortunately, was caused by just the political you know, politicians politicizing everything. And that was unfortunate, you know, being a little bit older and my friends being a little bit older, we've seen stuff like this before. And so we just said, well, okay, this too will pass, you know, make the best of it as we go through. And unfortunately, you know, especially a lot of younger people, they get caught up in all that stuff. I have a friend of mine right now with all the debt ceiling limit and stuff. And she's just so paranoid about whether, you know, what's going to happen and everything. But, you know, they're going to play politics and they're going to figure it out and, you know, life will go on.
Yeah. And I think that is a challenge, you know, so much of social media plays such a part in how people are reacting to and gathering information. And that's so important. I think about, you know, the overlap of when the pandemic first started, you know, there was that sense of fear. People were afraid, didn't know what was going on. Then you get to that space where it's like, okay, I need to, you know, the World Health Organization and the CDC started telling people about, oh yeah, these are things that you need to do. You need to wear a mask. You need to do these things. And so then we started to become more familiar with what we needed to do.
Right.
Kind of took some of the fear away from some. And then you had some who were going and they were making masks and they were telling people how to make disinfectants and things like that. And they were stepping in and reaching back to help those who were still struggling through the fear and struggling through the education. Mm-hmm. And so there's just so much that's out there. You know, this is the age of technology and we have access to so much information, but we still have people who are just like, I don't know what to do, or I'm still in fear. I don't know what to do. There are still people who are double masking. There are still people who are living in that state of fear. And so there are just so many emotions that are going on so many different levels. And we all experience the same thing at the same time. So that's something that was different. We all were experiencing at the same time, but we all had different reactions to it.
Different ways of coping with it, you know, based upon your experience and just, you know, how you look at the world. It's interesting because when I first started practicing, it was before the internet. And one of the things I used to tell my clients is quit watching the evening news.
Right.
You know, that in itself made a difference for a lot of them. And nowadays, of course, the equivalent is all the social media and all the stuff. Sometimes you just got to put that stuff over there, you know, and take what you need to do out of it, you know, but don't have that constant drumbeat of, oh, this is going on, that's going on, this is terrible, that's terrible. You know, there's only so much you can do, you know, and so take the steps you could do and then quit listening to some of that stuff, you know, put on something that's uplifting.
Right. I remember when TV used to go off, you know, you used to get that little snow screen, you know, 10 o'clock, or at midnight, off. There was no 24-hour access to all this news with so many different opinions. And, you know, for every positive thing, there was a negative that go. Yeah, there's just so much information out there that's just, you know, some people don't know which way to go or, you know.
And they don't have quiet time where they can process stuff, because they're constantly moving from one thing to another, one input to another. And I think especially the younger generation, that's one of the things that they still need to learn is how to just shut it off, have some quiet time and recenter yourself.
And that is so critical. You know, those of us who are older and in age, you know, we're like, yeah, you know, we're like, take a chill pill. You know? we're like, relax a little bit. There's a lot going on, and you don't have to be involved in everything. And right. I think one thing that's interesting is, you know, this is the first time that we have five different generations in the same workforce. And so just dealing with the different personalities, you know, there are some of us saying, you know, I've heard people call us old heads, and they're just like, you know, y'all are old heads. And we're just like, we could have never gotten away with some of the things that some of the younger generation are getting away with. Or we wouldn't ask questions. We didn't ask questions. We did what we were told. There are so many different dynamics that are going on. And we have to be so open-minded now to understand.
I'm from the 60s generation, so we were rabble rousers. we raised a little Cain in our day, so.
That's it. I was right there. I'm a 1970. I was born in 1970, so I'm a 1970 baby. Yeah. And yes, you know, we were those ones who we did as we were told. We didn't ask too many questions. We respected authority, and it's just a different dynamic now. But emotions are still the same.
Yeah, it's interesting how the generations go back and forth. So
yeah. And that's the thing. So, I mean, like I said, even though we have different things that are happening, or we've had this situation where we all experienced this same the same ideal of pandemic at the same time, and our reactions have been different, it still leads me to that whole question of emotions and triggers and things that you discuss in your book, why you feel the way you do. So, you know, like I said, I want to talk a little bit about that and the premise, and, you know, what prompted you to write this book?
Oh, I've been interested in emotions ever since I was a kid. My parents were from farm environments, and we had a fairly large plot of land. So we had rabbits and chickens and cats and dogs and a parrot. And, you know, I just enjoyed working with the animals. I enjoyed my chickens. I would train them to get up on little boxes and stuff for the cats and the dogs and things, you know, and the parrot. And so animal behaviors always fascinated me. And so when I got my degree in biology, it was my interest was animal behavior. And then later on, I switched over to, of course, human behavior. And, you know, a lot of parallels between them. We have the same emotional circuits that they have, which is actually something that's fairly new. It used to be a lot of psychologists said, you know, animals don't have emotions. They're just little conditioned response boxes. And anybody who had a pet knew that was just nonsense, you know. And so now they've actually identified the circuits that we share with our animals. And it's been really interesting since 2000, especially some of the stuff that's been coming out.
Wow, you see, and that is something, like you said, unless you have pets, you don't know. We only know the limited amount that we were taught in our science classes, and, you know, Pavlov's dog, you know, and the bell and all these other things. Yeah. So those are the limited things that we were taught, but, you know, never realized how much. But I guess that explains why people are so attached to their dogs and their cats and, you know, their pets like that, because there are those parallels there.
We are wired for a relationship. In fact, we share that with other mammals. You see that, in dogs and cats and wolves and, other animals. And we have that wiring very strongly inside of us. You actually have two circuits. You have two fear circuits. One is danger. And the other one is that we see, call it separation anxiety in children. They call it the panic circuit. And as adults, that's what causes you to miss people, is that same circuit. And it has a corresponding caring circuit, which again, if you watch on a playground, a kid fall down, the other kids immediately kind of look with concern, that gets kicked in. And that's part of also what bonds us together as people, being as adults, right? And with your friends and your mate and your kids, and that is those two circuits kind of working back and forth together. And they're very powerful. There's a couple of other circuits that are really interesting. One is the play circuit. And in fact, let me back up and just explain what I'm talking about here. Neurobiologists, they talk about affects, okay? And affects are things that cause you to get up and do something. The simplest ones are heat, cold, pressure. So if I'm cold, the colder I am, the more I'm motivated to get up and get warm, right? And the hotter I am, the more I'm motivated to get up and get cool. Or if I'm sitting too long, the pressure makes me want to sh shuffle around. The next level up are what they call homeostatic affects, and hunger and thirst are the two big ones that keep the balance in your body. And the emotions are kind of the third level on top of that. And again, we have seven of them. We've already talked about a couple of them. The play circuit in mammals help us to find social limits. In fact, if you've worked with little kids, well, you work with kids, so you know all the time. They learn what too much is by doing too much, right? So they're playing and they start, going beyond what the limit should be or the boundaries. And then you say, "Oh, that's a little too much there." And so quit poking the gorilla, right? And so you learn social limits a lot of times through play. And as adults, of course, we continue to enjoy play. It's a way that we interact. Humor is very fun. And another one that's kind of interesting that we don't often think about it as an emotion, but it is something called seeking. And you see this in babies. They want to go out and they want to explore the environment. They're touching everything, they're chewing on everything, And as adults, we still have that. When you go into a new place, the first thing you do is you look around and you check everything out. And it's actually an emotional drive that forces us to kind of explore our environment for what's good and what's bad. Is there danger? Are there good things out there? Or is it all just neutral? And it's just like anger or fear, it's an emotional response inside of us. And of course, anger is another one, and then lust is the last one. And we all encountered lust during puberty, right? So
Right. That is so, I mean, to me, it's so cool how yes, they all come in certain at certain times, just like you were saying, when we're young and that seeking and we're in that curiosity. And then somewhere, to me, as we get a little older, yes, we're still seeking, but it doesn't always seem as sharp. Then
Well, all of these things get
so.
motivated, get controlled, and they get modified by your experiences and your belief systems. So they can actually shut down. I mean, the saddest case is babies that would come in from Eastern Europe from orphanages where they're never cared for. And so that panic circuit, the separation anxiety, actually would shut down. And they would quit crying, they'd quit seeking attention. And when they got adopted, they had what were called attachment disorders. They had a hard time attaching to other people. And, with other conditions like autism and stuff, you can see how sometimes the circuitry goes off. And depending upon your experiences, whether you're allowed to explore and allowed to play and have fun and have relationships, that will enhance those circuits. And otherwise, they get dampened down. Plus, of course, the wiring's different. Some people are musical, some people aren't. Some people can do math, some people can't, So the same thing with the circus, they vary from person to person. So
Yeah, and I mean, and I think that's the important thing too, that there is just no blanket way that we react or respond to things. Again, just like we were talking about the pandemic, there are some people who are just like, okay, I'm good with this. There are some people who are just like, oh my goodness, the world just ended. I can't go outside. What am I supposed to do? So there are different responses, just like you said, based on experience. And that's something that's important to remember, and I think about that. And just like you said, I've worked with children. I've worked in the field of education, and a lot of what I hear in my experience is, you know, talking about children being on the spectrum and talking about, you know, autism and talking about other things that may affect their quote unquote circuitry and just trying to determine, you know, what are some of those things that, you know, I don't know whether the correct word is whether those are some of the things that trigger certain things to occur, you know. How does, I'm not clear on necessarily how that works.
Well, you know, the variation, people that have, you know, they call it neurodiversity nowadays, like my son's ADD, right? And a lot of them are very good with their hands. Like he's great with mechanics and building and stuff. He's got some rentals he does. And he thinks outside of the box very well. You know, with kids, of course, it's hard to get them into the box sometimes. at part of the problem nowadays, I think, is we don't have a place for a lot of these people. You know, we expect a lot of our schools are set up for well-behaved little girls, right? It's like boys, they can't run, they can't, you know, they can't tag, they can't play rough and stuff, and so they're expected to sit there quietly and do things, and you know, for a lot of them, that's just not how they're wired. So part of it in the old days, you know, you could farm, you could go hunt, you could explore, you know, had lots of things and options you could do, and those options I think are more limited nowadays in our culture than they used to be. If you weren't good, you know, if you were ADD and you'd like to run and play and do, you know, physical things, you could go do that, you know, and well, I guess he's just not a book person, so they send him off and do stuff. But there's no place for that type of person to fit in easily nowadays. I think recognizing some of these things, we're starting to accommodate some of it. But it's still something we're still trying to figure out. So it's a work in progress.
Yeah, it definitely is. And then I think about the whole technology aspect, too. There are some people that are not, you know, they're not good with technology. There are some people who don't have access to technology. And when we got to a space where that was the main way that people were communicating, what happens to those who don't have access to that? And so, you know, it just, like you said, it becomes a challenge. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you're right. There are some constructs that or, you know, things that are set up, you know, in society that make it difficult for the person, just like you said, who doesn't fit into that quote unquote social, you know, or emotional norm. And so then what happens to them? It's not that there's something wrong with them. It's just that accommodations have not been made to meet their need, you know, and that's important.
Yeah, and just finding their niche sometimes becomes a challenge. It's interesting because one of the things you mentioned, technology, and this is more so, I think, with younger generations, is one of the things you're seeing is a lot of anxiety and depression because of social media and technology. And it's because, as we've said, one of our basic needs is human relationship. And a lot of kids, especially coming through COVID, children who are not allowed to go to school, you find a lot of them have troubles with socialization, in addition to some of their academics being behind. And even older kids where they're plugged into their, you know, the saddest thing for me is to go to a restaurant and see both parents on their cell phone and their kid on, you know, his device, and nobody's talking or interacting. We need human interaction. And if we don't get face-to-face, you know, connection with people, then we have difficulties in life. And a lot of times we don't realize that that's where it's coming from. You know, there's the old saying that if you got three friends that you can talk to about anything and they will accept you for who you are, then you probably don't have to worry about your mental health too much. And it's amazing how many people don't even have one or two friends that they can talk to nowadays. I've got 500 friends on Facebook. Yeah,
right.
I don't have anybody I could be real with it face to face, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that it's dampened our ability, you know, or it's dampened our emotions, because how often do we just go with the emojis and go with the, you know, you know, or we hide behind our technology, you know, just like when people ask you, oh, you know, how are you doing? And I say, I'm fine. Yeah. But when they look at you, they can look at you and say, nah, you're not fine. You're not looking the way, you know, you're not looking the way you normally look, Kim. You're not okay. But we've been conditioned to say that. But now when we go behind, you know, social media or go behind technology, you put the little smiley face and that person is not connecting with us to know that something is wrong. then we hear about rape. So, you know, with people committing suicide and people saying, oh my goodness, well, I didn't know. How, you know, how would you know if we're not making that physical connection or having that communication that puts us together so that we can, you know, we can feed off each other's energy. And that's very difficult to do when we're hiding behind a device, a tablet or a phone. Right. That's something that's puzzling.
Yeah, well, one of the things that kicked off at 2000 was the a field called positive psychology. They sometimes call it science of happiness. And when you look at the research, it's interesting because there's three things that come out that make people happy and satisfied in their life. And the first one is exactly what we've been talking about, relationship, you know, having some deep, meaningful relationship. Second one is purpose. And that's the other one that a lot of people, they don't have a purpose in life, or they're having trouble finding it, or their purpose is very narrow. You know, my purpose is to make the most widgets I can, or to, you know, raise my kids, which works fine until that's over, right? Right. And then the third one, which is the one that's hardest and kind of ties into these other ones and kind of works with your purpose, but it's meaning. You know, what is your meaning in life? And meaning, how do you answer the big questions for, you know, why am I here? You know, is there life after death? You know, what is the ultimate goal for me in life? And those types of questions. And if you have some kind of a context where you can put things into when they go south, because you mentioned that earlier, you know, somebody dies, you have a sickness, there's a crisis, you don't run out of money. That sense of meaning is what allows you to give context to that and to ride through it. In fact, when you look at people who go through really terrible experiences, but come out fine, or not fine, but they come out okay, intact at the end, usually the two things you see is they have that they have relationship, somebody or some people they can rely upon, and they have that sense of meaning that they're really clear about. You know, they have a spiritual, existential belief system that helps them to kind of put that stuff they're going through into context. And that's the other thing that you find is very lacking in a lot of people nowadays. And so they substitute their political beliefs, or they substitute some, you know, cause that they're going to, and that becomes kind of their religion. And yet they haven't gone beyond that to say, well, how does that fit in with the other things, you know, in my life? So, yeah, so relationship, purpose, and meaning are the three big things that, that people need to take a look at. And we don't do that very often.
Yeah, and that is unfortunate, because it does affect how we respond to crises or situations. And those who know me and know my background know that I lost my youngest daughter 14 years ago. She had a brain aneurysm and she passed at the age of 16. And people are like, I could never imagine losing my child. That's not something that's easy for you know, any parent or grandparent or auntie, uncle, you know, to have to deal with. And for me, it was my faith, you know, and you know, that helped me to be able to understand that, you know. And for me personally, I said, you know, God doesn't make mistakes. There was a reason why she was here. She was here for the time that she was meant to be here. And I was blessed to, you know, have had her for 16 years of her life, you know, and to have spent that time with her, and to know that she touched lives and touched hearts and minds. And you know, that's not something that's easy for everybody to do. But it really has to deal with, it deals with your emotional state. It deals with those relationships. I had strong people behind me. My parents, you know, were, you know, my rock and my pillar during that time. You know, my understanding that, you know, my oldest daughter lost her only sibling. My parents lost their granddaughter. My sister lost her niece, you know. So, you know, there were reasons to live. I could have tried to crawl in the coffin with her.
Right.
That, you know, I needed to live for those who were still living. And so, you know, like I said, it's a different dynamic when you, you know, have an understanding of your emotions and where you can say, okay, what just happened, and what are some, what is it that I need to do? How am I feeling about this? Because I think when we do that, we can start looking for help, or at least start asking for the help that we need in order to cope.
And some of that's kind of a new phenomena too, because up until probably, oh, just a little bit before World War II, death was a pretty constant thing that was in people's lives. You know, people used to have 7 to 10 kids, and if half of them reached puberty, you were doing great. You know, they would die of, you know, childhood diseases, injury, you know, infections, all kinds of stuff. And with some of the antibiotics after World War II that came out and some of the other things that happened, a lot of people don't encounter death until they're actually fairly old. And so a lot of times they don't know how to deal with it. So yeah, I'm sorry for your loss, but yeah, it's difficult. I know, I've gone through some in my life and with my parents and stuff, but you know, having a context to put it in, I think faith is an important thing. That's something I always fall back on.
Yes. And there are so many people out there. You have people out there who you know have limited beliefs in that as well. So I mean, there are just so many dynamics, and like you said, it's so individual. You know, to us, there's no one blanket thing. Just like you're talking about relationship, purpose, and meaning, that's going to be different for each and every one of us.
Yeah, there are some commonalities. You know, nowadays, a lot of people are very materialistic. You know, they see that, you know, when I dead, I'm gone, and so it's to get as much as I can while I'm here, right? And one of the things I like to point to them is some of the near-death research that's been going on in the 70s. I think it was 72, or maybe it was 82. Moody published a book, Life After Life, where he talked about near-death experiences, and that kicked off a lot of research. And now there's like an international organization that's collected literally thousands of these experiences, and there's been some scientific studies. In fact, I mentioned one in my book, where they say, you know, all of the mechanical explanations just fall apart because people talk about things in the operating room or in the next room or sometimes miles away. And sometimes you can go in, you can actually verify that these things happened the way they said they happened. And their conclusion, of course, being scientists, they're not quite a admit to any kind of metaphysical belief, but they said, you know, we don't know what's going on, but something's going on, you know. And the people that research it say, you know, we're all convinced that death is not the end. There's something going on. Now, what you do with that, again, something to think about. And I try to get people to start to think maybe beyond just, you know, the here and the now. And maybe there is something that goes on afterwards, and you need to think about that.
Those things are important. I mean, they are just, I mean, there are so many facets to our emotions and how we feel, and you know, it's coming to that place of self-actualization. I really feel like, you know, we have to really begin to tap into ourselves. And I think that, you know, even before the pandemic, there are a lot of people who are not comfortable sitting with themselves.
Yeah,
You know, to
that's a
say,
big thing.
yes, yeah, they're not comfortable with themselves because they really haven't, like you said, gotten to that science of happiness, or you know, experiencing relationships and purpose, and really having to sit down and say, okay, what is it that you know, what is the meaning of my life? What is the purpose? You know, then they start looking at the relationship that they in. Are they toxic relationships? There's so much that we have to do. And I think another, you know, buzzword that we're hearing a lot recently is, you know, people and their lack of empathy, you know, discounting how people feel about things. And that's something that's been a challenge for some. You know, yeah, you hear on social media, oh my goodness, you're being extra. Oh my gosh, you know, what, you know, you're doing the most. You know, we hear those terminologies. And for that person, it's real to them. What they're experiencing is real. And we have seen people discount how other people feel, and they have that lack of empathy. And that's, I think, that's a hard pill for me, you
Well,
know.
there is a hardening of society, and it comes from a lot of the media that we put our heads into. You know, you look at the horror movies from 1930s, and they were really tame compared to what we see nowadays, because they got to keep upping. You know, it's that dopamine push, right? You know, you get accustomed to it, so now I need a bigger push to get my emotions up, and so things become more and more and more extreme as we go along. And That's not healthy for society. But unfortunately, we're still like little kids dealing with a lot of our technology. So we're figuring out how to manage it.
Yeah.
But empathy, it starts in the home. And if the parents aren't teaching that to the kids, and I think this, what we were talking about earlier, where the parents are on their phones and the kids are on their thing, and there's not a lot of interconnection, that's a piece of the puzzle. It's not the whole thing, but certainly encouraging kids to get together when they come and play, put the phones away. I know my niece, that's the thing they do with her kids, is they come in the house and they got a basket, they put the phones in there. So, and they just have a flip phone so they can call an emergency. They can't, surf the internet while they're away. So yeah, it's there are things you can do. Parental controls, you can limit how long the Wi-Fi is on in the house. And so it goes off. You can monitor, what your kids are into. And you need to do that. Otherwise, they are going to grow up in this unempathetic and harsh kind of attitude towards life in the world.
Yeah, and I think it also starts with the parents too, or, families. I mean, it's so difficult to say parents now because families look so different now.
Exactly, exactly.
And so, we have siblings raising their younger siblings. We have, two moms, two dads. We have grandparents and, adoptive families. We have so many different dynamics and people who are, in that rat race of working, 12, 16 hours. And when they're working their 16 hour shifts, then they're door dashing the rest of the day, And so, even that limited supervision for some of the children, some of us were latchkey kids, but it's a whole different realm of latchkeyness.
It's different. Yeah, I mean, my mom worked. She was unusual back for my generation. So yeah, I came home and made dinner and all that stuff. But
you did all of that.
But again, it was a different generation, different time, because we had organizations and stuff. I was in youth organizations and stuff where I got to interact and, do a lot of the stuff. And they're out there today, but you have to make an effort to make sure, your children are involved with that type of stuff. Because they do learn it through experience. And if they're just being taught by the TV and the internet, you're going to have an adult who is lacking in a lot of key areas.
Okay, so let's start talking about some of the things that we can do to start looking at ourselves. And in turn, it will trickle down to our children and to our youth. When people come to you, or they're coming to you, are they coming to you with a specific question or a specific issue that is going on with them? Or are they coming because they've been diagnosed with something? How do they come to you?
Well, in my practice, people came to me primarily because they were having panic attacks or some other kind of anxiety-related issue going on in their life. And so when I first started, people had been suffering from panic attacks for, 20 years or so. And so it was very entrenched in their life. And by the end, people had just experienced their first panic attack maybe 3 or 4 months before, which was nice because now it's in a much quicker resolution for that problem. And then, other people, with OCD or simple phobias or, social anxiety, things of that nature, they usually had an issue, something that was interfering with their life in some way. And so that's why I would work with them. And, there's a set of things you do with them, for example, like with panic disorder and with all of these things, and no matter what you're doing, even like in my book, when I talk about just the core response patterns that people have that they may want to change a little bit. The first thing I think is to come up with a simple explanation for where that's coming from. People waste a lot of time. I don't understand why, how come, gee, why is this going on? Why, I think I know why it's going on, but why is this still happening? Right. And so I would say the first thing we need to do is come up with a simple little paragraph that you can say to yourself. So like with panic disorder, it was, I've got a reactive body. I got in a period of stress. I basically had a stress reaction that I didn't understand, and I started worrying about it. I started talking myself into this anxiety attacks and, something of that nature. Something that's probably more maybe widespread, let's say somebody grows up in an environment where there's a lot of violence. And there's different ways you can cope with that as a kid. You can become real aggressive, or you can learn to be quiet, right? And to not stand up. And, you know, and as a label, we could say they learned that conflict is dangerous. Okay. And so now as an adult, they're in situations where maybe they want to do something or speak up, but they don't. You know, maybe they don't speak up at work. Maybe people suggest things when they're eating, but they want to eat something else, but they'll go with the other person's suggestion. You know, so that becomes a kind of a pattern in their life. And so by putting a label on it, you know, conflict is dangerous, now gives me a way to think about it. And so then first step is explanation. So explanation would be, okay, I grew up in an environment where if I spoke up, bad things happen. So I learned to keep quiet and not to rock the boat. Yeah, it's very simple, right? So now the next step is what I do about it, right? Because that's where you want to get to. You want to answer the why so you can move on to what do we do about it. And what I then have people do is let's identify places in your life where that's interfering, where it comes up. So it comes up at work, it comes up when I'm watching TV, I want to watch this program, but you know, my partner or my friend wants to watch something else. I always watch what they want to watch. I never assert myself and try to compromise. Okay, that would be an example. Comes up, like we said earlier, at work possibly, not speaking up in meetings or not expressing my opinions. So you come up with a list of things and you start with the simple ones and you practice the opposite positive. One of the behavioral approaches to change in behavior is when you have a negative behavior, you have to practice the opposite positive. You start with the easy stuff first, and it might just simply be saying, you know, I want to watch this program. I would really like to watch this program. Could we maybe, of course, it's easier today with all the stuff you let your streaming, but can we watch this one and then watch yours? Okay, or could I watch mine after you? You know, come up with some kind of a compromise. So start speaking up. Having some things to tell yourself. It's okay to speak up. You know, I'm safe now. You know, my partner is not going to yell at me and, you know, do bad things to me like my parents did. My partner loves me. My partner is going to be, is willing to be, to compromise with me, to be reasonable with me. So having things that you say to yourself, and that's kind of the four basic things, you know, your explanation, identifying places where it's coming up, practicing the opposite positive, and having self-talk that's going to reinforce that. One of the other interesting ones that I would encounter a lot with people is intimacy is painful. You grow up in an environment where you try to get close to your parents and they distance themselves. So there's not a lot of intimacy in the house, right? And as an adult, they get in a relationship and they'll complain, you know, I don't understand. Every time I get close, I mess it up. Mm-hmm. I do something to mess it up. And, you know, it's because on an unconscious level, intimacy has been paired with pain. And so you start to get close and all the bells and whistles go off and you make distance, right? And so understanding that as a dynamic and then practicing it becomes something you need to do. It's interesting when you work with people that come from really dysfunctional backgrounds. One of the things we talk about is what does healthy look like? You know, what is healthy boundaries, healthy disclosure, you know, those types of things look like. Let's try to find some people in your environment that fits some of those categories, right? Because usually all their friends come from just as dysfunctional families as they come from, right? You surround yourself with people that have similar things that you have, right? And that's just the case. So, you know, look for whether it's church or a social organization or work or whatever, they try to identify one or two people. And I say, okay, now you need to hang around them. Go to lunch with them, you know, spend some time with them. And you know what their complaint is always at first? These people are so boring. Absolutely no drama in their life at all.
Right.
But you know, if they hang around it for 3 to 6 months, they find that that really becomes comfortable because they don't know what being peaceful and comfortable is. They're used to always being, you know, in drama, always used to being on edge, always being excited, always anxious or angry or some other kind of, you know, high level emotion. And that quiet joy that you can experience is something that is foreign to them. It's just like with the panic disorder people, I would usually give them a relaxation response cassette that they could practice with, practicing relaxing and coming up with what we call a relaxation response trigger. And a lot of them would get anxious when they first start to listen to it because the feeling of relaxation was so foreign to them. they didn't understand what it felt like to have a relaxed body. They'd been wound up for so long. So yeah, but they get used to, once they get used to it, they like it, you know, if they can get over that initial hump.
But you're right. You tend to, you know, go back to what's comfortable for you, even if it's toxic. You know, it's something that you're so used
to. Well, I like to say it's what's familiar, not comfortable, but what's familiar. And that is interesting. You know, you can take somebody comes from a dysfunctional background and put them, you know, a single person, put them in a room full of 15 people. And within 15, 20 minutes, they'll be talking to the other people from dysfunctional backgrounds. And at that moment, everybody's presenting well. And so you say, how does that happen? Well, it happens because so much of our behavior is unconscious. You know, as you grow up, you get memories, and your memories get emotional tags, and good things and bad things. And the more emotional or the more important the event, the stronger the emotional tag. Mm-hmm. And people that come from healthy backgrounds, they don't know how to read them. Mm. They have appropriate, you know, disclosure, appropriate intimacy, those types of things. And it's just, they feel funny, and they get around people from a similar background, and okay, this I can read. Yeah. At an unconscious level, this feels familiar to me. Yeah. And that's why sometimes people will go from one relationship to another. That's just, you know, just a tragic mess. Because they don't know how to read what healthy, it's like they go into relationships with the blinders on. Because if you grow up in a healthy environment, you just naturally know what that feels like. And when you get somebody that's off, you can tell, okay, something's off with this person.
Right.
You know, and again, it's just because on an unconscious level, you're able to read them. It's just like your cats and dogs and your pets read you, your emotions. We all have that ability. You know, if I say, the simple phrase, I love you, I can say it three different ways. I can say, I love you. I love you. Hey, love you, babe. You know what each one of those mean without me having to explain it, because we have that ability to read people. And because we're so much thinking about stuff, we don't realize that we're picking up these cues all the time. And some people are more sensitive than others to that. But it is part of how we're wired, reading body language, facial expressions, tone of voice, which is, again, why face-to-face relationships is more valuable than an internet relationship. Although I'm not going to discount that. And when my daughter was in England, we would Zoom, you know, talk to her and stuff. And that was great. Yeah. Every Sunday afternoon, we get to connect with her, but we'd already built up a history of connection with her.
Right.
And so you need to have that full interaction with people, really to have that bond. That's going to be a long lasting one.
Yes, and like you said, that is something that is so critical, you know, and so important that we do, that we take the time to, you know, like you said, step away from some of that social media as well, and actually just be social.
Yeah.
Go back to, you know, talking to people and doing things. And one thing that you mentioned earlier is, you know, when you were talking about your clients coming, they had a panic attack, but they realized that something happened, that something occurred. And right. I think it's so important that we get to that place where we recognize that something is wrong and I need help. It's not something that I'm able to control on my own.
So, well, you know, and it's funny because I'd ask people, so tell me what was going on when you had your first panic attack. They'd say things like, well, you know, I was going to school full time and I was working, and let's see, my fiance decided didn't want to get married, and I was working, I was caring for my dad. He was sick at the time. You know, I don't understand why I had to, you know, it's like, wait a minute, you know,
right.
I think I figured it out, you know,
right. you
were just doing way too much. And unfortunately, a lot of times people are so out of touch with their body, they don't realize how stressed out they are. And I think media has contributed to this idea that I'm Superman. You know, you see the person who's been shot, you know, stabbed, beat up, thrown out of the car, and he's still charging along, you know, so like nothing happened.
Right. We become desensitized, I think, to a lot of things that are going on. Because remember when we were kids and we would see blood, we'd be like, and we'd cover our face every day. And now the kids are like, roll camera, you know, zoom in, you know, I want to see all that. You know, can you see the bones cracking? You know, we're just like, what?
But the point is we think we can do that too. And that's, you know, that's not reality, right? We are limited. We have, our body is a machine with a limited amount of energy. We can only do so much, and then it needs to be replenished. And whenever I'm working with whatever the problem happens to be, one of the things I always tell people is keep in mind that when you are sick, hungry, tired, or stressed, old stuff's going to come up. Because people will be working on a problem, they're getting better with intimacy, they're getting better with conflict, they're getting better with whatever, and then, you know, they'll have a relapse a little bit, and, you know, because they were sick and retired, or a lot of stress was going on in their life, and they'll say, oh my gosh, I'm back to square one, this is no good. But no, you know, change is, you know, it's a cyclical thing. It goes up and down, and during those times when you've got a lot of stuff going on in your life, you will dip back into old behaviors, you know, and that's just a normal part of the process. And being okay with that, knowing that I don't like it, but, you know, that's part of life, you know, and being kind to yourself and forgiving becomes important too. And it's also a message. When old stuff comes up, a lot of times it's a signal, like the little light on your dashboard of your car saying, you know, take care of business, you know, you're doing too much. Yeah. I mean, everybody's got things they do when they're getting stressed out. And the more you know your stress indicators, the better you are, because then you can, you know, oh, my stress indicators are going off. You know, I don't usually talk this way. I don't usually do this. I like to joke that my dad was a sailor. And so sometimes there's a change in how I use language. And, you know, it's an indicator, right?
Makes sense. It makes sense. But I like that. I like that. That whole indicator signal, just like you said, on your car, when that light comes on, you're like, uh-oh, it's about to happen. And it really is, it deals with us being, you know, in tune with ourselves and becoming familiar, like you said, with triggers, mm-hmm. things like that. And I know that you talk about that in your book as well, that you talk about triggers and things like that. And you know, what do we do when those things happen, you know?
Right. Well, it triggers, and again, we usually think of them as a negative thing. Again, there's a part of your mind that's control. Well, we are unconscious most of the day. Let me start with that. You think about just walking. You know, there's a part of your mind that's judging distance, that's coordinating your body. It's on alert for anything that might get in your way and you stumble over, anything that might be a good thing that you may want to take a look at. And all the while, you're thinking about, what am I going to eat? Gee, what am I going to watch on TV? Or, you know, some other thing like that. And it's good that that subconscious part of your brain can take care of all the stuff, you know, while you're thinking about other stuff. But at the same time, sometimes you get some stuff in there labeled as danger or bad that really isn't. So as you grow up again, you have experiences, and then there's an emotional tag that gets associated with those experiences. The more important, the stronger the emotional tag. And now that unconscious part of your brain, whenever it notices it, it'll alert you to it. So if I've been in a bad car accident, the sights, the sounds, the smells, you know, everything that was going on at that moment will get registered on my brain as danger. And so when I encounter it again, this is PTSD, right? Post-traumatic stress type of stuff. So I had a client once, and they were doing great. You know, they totally desensitized. The accident had happened on a curve during the night when it was raining. They were out driving one night when the rain, they hit a curve that was very similar, and they had, you know, a brief episode of anxiety came up. So those triggers, you know, they're down there, and if you get enough of them triggering at the same time, you know, it will cause a reaction. And of course, if you've grown up, like if you're in a war theater, or if you've grown up through a childhood where there's a lot of stuff going on, then those triggers become very strong because you've got a lot of repetition of them. And so those are the ones that you want to quiet. And again, part of it's understanding what's going on, identifying when do those triggers come up, and then having things you can do to calm yourself when those triggers come up, both in things you tell yourself. I'm thinking of a lady at work who got anxious around a fellow coworker, and she didn't understand why. And talking about it, realized that he looked similar to a parent, voice was similar to the parent, it's a lot of his mannerisms. So she used something that I call what's happening, what's real. What's happening is this person reminds me of that parent that did some things to me that I didn't like, that were not good. What's real is this person is not my parent. He's just a coworker. I'm an adult now. We're just working together. And so using that type of self-talk she eventually became friends and comfortable with this person, right? She desensitized to those triggers that were going on inside of her.
And yeah, a lot of it comes from within. A lot of it comes from being able to talk through it. And like you said, you know, when we were talking about those things that we need to do, we need to, you know, have an explanation for, you know, why we're feeling the way we're feeling, you know, where is it coming up? Or when is it happening? Yeah. And then, you know, being able to answer that question, why, and that opposite positive, like you said, that positive self-talk, you know, and being able to get to those spaces. You know, these are just some of the, you know, few things
and having tools to calm yourself, you know, and again, with extreme anxiety, I would use things like relaxation response, breathing, stuff of that nature, distraction. But it's you can desensitize to literally anything if you go about it in the right way. I mean, you look at the things that people desensitize themselves to in an operating theater, a war theater, or whatever. You know, so same thing with behavior. If you've got things that are triggering you in life, if you approach it correctly, you can get to the point where those triggers will quiet down. Occasionally, they'll fire when you're sick, hungry, tired, stressed out, right? But that gets better over time, the more the quieter and quieter you make them. Which brings me to one other thing that I just wanted to say, is that we read a lot about reprogramming, deleting programs, this type of stuff. And human beings are not computers. We are not digital. We are not wires, and we are organic beings. And so the way your nerves and stuff work is like a muscle. You know, you have to work it over time to strengthen it. Or if you don't work it over time, it becomes weak, right? So it's the same type of process.
Right, so it's not just the physical, it's the emotional. Oh, yeah, I have a friend who she's a mental fitness coach. And it's just as important, like you said, to exercise that mental muscle as it is your physical muscles, you know, and you said they're not going to gain strength or be toned if we're not, you know, engaging them. So it's definitely important to do that. And I love that whole concept of what's happening, what's real, you know, to let people understand that, you know, this is something that's animated. This is something that's not, you know, I think about, I have worked in the childcare industry, and they talk about using real life pictures as opposed to using the little animated pictures, because we want children to associate that this is a real person, and this is something that happens in reality. This is not something that's like a cartoon that you watch on TV. Mm-hmm. So they even try to teach them from a young age to start associating with this is what's real. Like you said, this is not something that's imaginary or fiction, you know, or you know, something that's not real. It's actually something that they can associate with. You know, so those things are important, like you said, as you know, to teach our youngsters, but it's also important for us to get back to that. We talk about sometimes, you know, scripturally speaking, you know, talk about being childlike in your behavior and in your thoughts. And sometimes it's important for us to go back to some of those things, because it opens our minds up to you know, being curious and being, you know, excited about learning new things and not, you know, feeling limited by our experience or having our experiences shut us down to where we, you know, become immobile.
Yeah.
Or we become, you know, or we lack empathy because we just can't see beyond, you know, our limited thinking. That's important. That's important. But what I do want to say is I know we're winding down on time, but
okay.
I mean, your book, okay, the name of his book is Why You Feel the Way You Do. Mm-hmm. And I have started diving into that book. It is a wonderful, wonderful book. I love the way it's set up. I love the way you have, you know, at the end of each chapter, how you know, talk about some of those things that are happening at the end of the chapter. And then you give some steps or some action items that people can do, you know, as they go through each chapter. And I think that is phenomenal. So the one thing I want to do is have you tell us how people can get in contact with you and how they can grab a copy of your book.
Easiest way is to go to my website, whyemotions.com. So whyemotions.com. And I've got a direct link into the publisher as well as to Amazon. And there's audio and ebook versions of it as well. So go to whyemotions.com, and I've got my other books are there. I've got some freebie stuff. The relaxation response things that I use with my clients is all there. But one of the interesting ones is the pregnancy prep series. I use that with my wife, and we developed the relaxation response trigger on her shoulder and knee. So right after a contraction, I'd just say, relax, and she could relax right after the contraction. You know, the gynecologist looked at me and said, geez, this stuff really work. I said, oh yeah, just watch this. So yeah.
See, that's awesome. Awesome. Yeah. So you got some wonderful things. So again, so you heard it. It is whyemotions.com, whyemotions.com. And that will definitely be in the description when the show airs. And again, the title of that book is Why You Feel the Way You Do. So like I said, we've shared a lot of little nuggets here, things that people can start looking into, but definitely grab a copy of the book. It is phenomenal. And you know, I want to say thank you, Renu, for coming in and you know, sharing some of this information with us, because it's so vital in this society that we're living in. But we need to, you know, tap in and start, you know, really seeing why we feel the way we do and how our emotions, you know, impact us, you know, in our personal and professional lives and in our relationships with each other. So I think.
And it helps us manage them a bit more effectively, I think.
Yes, so. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, know that you are always welcome to come back on the show. And, you know, because I always say what's happening now may not be what's happening 2 hours, 2 weeks, or 2 years from now. So you're always welcome to come back and talk about things that are going on in your now. So again, thank you so much for being here. Now, one question that I always ask each of my guests before the end of each show is how you are living in the now. How are you navigating in the space that you're in right now?
Well, the thing that I do is I get centered. So again, I'm a person of faith. So I read scripture and I take some time to pray and meditate. And that puts my day in context, and it helps me go through life not getting upset by a lot of the stuff that a lot of other people are freaking out over. I mean, I know where I'm going, I know who's in charge, and that just gives you a peace that, you know, goes beyond understanding.
And it's a mental exercise. It's not something that happens overnight. It happens, you know, it's not a sprint, it's a journey.
Yeah,
you to get to that space where you can realize and recognize the things that are going on around you and take those proper responses. So I love it.
Taking that time just to quiet yourself and to put things in context is so important. And it's a discipline. And sometimes I'm not very good at it. Sometimes I'm good at it. And when I'm not very good at it, I'm a little more anxious. Some of the other stuff, some of the old stuff comes up more. So. It's the way life is.
That's it. That's exactly it. That's the way life is. You know, it's never going to be perfect. Yeah. You know, we're going to, like you said, it's cyclical.
Yeah.
Right. And yeah, we're going to go through ebbs and flows, but it's just a matter of making sure that we have the tools necessary to meet the need that we're addressing at the time. So again, thank you so much for being here with us. We appreciate you. Any other final parting words that you'd like to give our listeners before we go?
Well, I think if you're struggling with something in your life, there are tools you can learn. I mean, one of the things as a clinician, as you mentioned from the book, is I'm real big on giving people tools. And whether it's my book or it's going sitting down with somebody or, you know, somebody else's book, you know, go find some tools. You don't have to struggle. You don't have to continue to be where you're stuck. You know, things can change.
Things can change. So again, like I said, you are now officially part of the How Now family. And again, thank you so much for being here. And we look forward to keeping in touch and you know, seeing what's next for you moving forward. So again, thanks again.
Thank you.
So that will do it for this edition of the How Now podcast, where we talk about how to live in the now. And until we see you the next time, I say peace.